You're listening to a podcast by the Queensland Clinical Senate, bringing you interviews with clinicians and leaders from across the Queensland health system.
My name's Lachlan McIver. I'm a rural generalist and public health physician from the Misty Mountains of Far North Queensland.
Lachlan, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us on the Senate podcast.
Pleasure, Rebecca. Thanks so much for having me.
Now, you're from a small town called Miller Miller in Far North Queensland, and I believe it has a population of about 500. Was medicine the expected path for a Miller Miller local?
I can tell you, I don't think it was 500 population when I was growing up, Rebecca. It was about half that, and they were almost all members of my extended family, if you get my drift. Look, it's a beautiful little town. It's a blink and you miss it place on the Palmerston Highway if you're heading inland from Innisfail. Famous for its waterfalls. In fact, Miller Miller, in the language of the local Mamu people, the traditional owners of the land, means lots of water or plenty of water. And Miller Miller Falls is the most photographed waterfall in the country. So there you go. If anyone's never heard of Miller Miller, you might have seen it or seen its most famous representation. And look, I can't speak for the town or its population in terms of what their careers usually have in store, but it usually involves agriculture, I think it would be fair to say. It's a dairy farming community. I grew up on a little beef cattle property, a little island of beef in the ocean of dairy. I believe I'm not the first doctor to have been born and raised in Miller Miller, but there's not many of us, put it that way.
Okay, so why did you choose medicine?
When I was 16, my 49-year-old father went out for his weekly run on a drizzly Sunday afternoon and never came back. So I jumped in our family station wagon and drove down the dirt road to go and look for him, thinking he'd just stopped off at the neighbor's place for a chat or something, and found him dead on the side of the road. It turned out that he'd had a massive myocardial infarction and died on the spot, hopefully very swiftly. I'm maybe taking a bit of poetic license to say that in that moment, I decided to become a doctor. Medicine was sort of in the back of my mind, but it probably wasn't top of the list in terms of career choices or university studies. But it definitely launched me quite a lot further down that road towards choosing medicine as a career when that tragedy happened to me and my family. So yeah, then I was fortunate enough to get into medicine and get a scholarship to go and do it, which was a sort of key factor given our family financial situation. And yeah, off from Miller Miller to Melbourne I went.
Lachlan, you're a rural and remote tropical medicine and public health specialist. What got you into those specialty areas?
A combination of slow burning interest and process of elimination, I think it would be fair to say. I want to give credit to Monash University Medical School and the experience I had there in the late 90s and early 2000s. It was a fairly traditional undergraduate medical program. There was three preclinical years filled with mostly science and then three clinical years with mostly clinical placements, but very little of that did anything to inspire me personally. And I was increasingly flummoxed as I looked around at my classmates, including my best mates, as they all seemed to commit to and saddle up for specialty training at what I perceived to be very early stages of their career. Basically before they finished med school, they decided what they want to be. Medical school for me was mostly deciding what I didn't want to be. Medical school experience in that era didn't offer a lot of exposure to remote medicine, tropical medicine, or public health. So I discovered all that a little bit later. And it was once I'd graduated, moved to Western Australia, had done my internship, which I was surprised and relieved to discover I quite enjoyed after all. I then went out into the bush and did a public health resident job and did some ED, which were the two things that I felt I was at least a little bit interested in. But I discovered in my second and third postgraduate years that it was really the combination of the acute medicine, the big picture population health, and most importantly, being in the bush, being in rural and remote and Indigenous communities, that's what I liked. And so I eventually realized that I could make a career out of all that and embarked on specialty training with the Australian College of Rural and Remote Medicine. Once I'd completed that, I then did a second round of specialty training with the College of Physicians, the Faculty of Public Health Medicine. And along the way, the Australasian College of Tropical Medicine kind of threw me a bone in the form of their fellowship as well. So that was the sort of combination of training that equipped me with the skills and knowledge that I was then able to apply in the I guess, the broad field of what you might call global health.
And you did work for Queensland Health for some time in northern Queensland, didn't you?
Still do. Look, Queensland is my home. I'm a proud Queenslander. And although my training and adventures have took me all around the country and subsequently all around the world, I do still consider Queensland to be home or part of my home or one of my homes. And so I'm proud to have worked for Queensland Health for periods of several years on and off. I did a year of anaesthetics in Cairns as part of my ACRM training, then worked for a couple of years all up in the Torres Strait. And there's many rural hospitals around the state that have seen me darken their doors over the years. These days when I'm back in Australia, it's because my family's in Cairns and still on the tablelands, Millamilla, et cetera. I try to keep my clinical cameos close to home. So Innisfail Hospital is where I tend to appear most often these days, which is quite lovely because I went to high school there. And so, you know, as you know, as many of your listeners know, patients certainly appreciate it when you've got some personal connection to the community. So that's really nice.
For sure. That's lovely. Now, in researching for our interview, your bio says that you've treated patients in some of the most isolated, volatile, and resource-deprived places on the planet. What's been one of the most difficult situations that you've worked in, Lachlan?
Look, there are some examples that are isolated and resource-deprived and volatile, and some of it are just one or two of those things, Rebecca. So if I could take the liberty of perhaps giving you, say, three different examples. Some of them might surprise you, listeners. So the Torres Strait is a fascinating place to work. I would say it's a unique region, and I mean that from a global perspective. There are no other examples, to my knowledge, of two countries that share a border where the difference, the discrepancies in health and socioeconomic indicators are so vast and dramatic. I think a lot of Australians don't fully appreciate that we have a border. There's this sort of myth or delusion that Australia is this remote, isolated island continent. But in fact, the Australia-PNG border is a very busy, porous one. There's hundreds of people going back and forth regularly under the terms of the Torres Strait Treaty. And what it means is as a clinician in the Torres Strait, you're treating not just Torres Strait Islander patients, but many patients from Papua New Guinea who are coming to the Queensland health facilities in the islands and ultimately often on the hospital in Thursday Island. We're often dealing with pretty wild stuff in the Torres Strait. I've treated tuberculosis and rheumatic heart disease in a clinic really just under a mango tree in the jungle of Vanuatu. And when it comes to volatile, I've got plenty of examples of those, but I guess most recently I was evacuated along with my colleagues from a project in the sort of remote mountains of northeastern Democratic Congo when our drivers were ambushed and kidnapped and the project was suspended.
Wow.
So, yeah, plenty of war stories. Let me just put it that way, Rebecca.
So you're now in Geneva. How did you end up there and what's your role?
So I'm currently the Tropical Diseases and Planetary Health Advisor at the Geneva headquarters of Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders. And I'm privileged to have that role. I have always admired and respected MSF, which is the acronym they usually are known by. And this role combines, you know, two of my main interests, which is the clinical tropical medicine and the big picture public health, with a sort of leaning quite heavily into planetary health, so climate change and environmental degradation. So, I feel privileged to have this role with MSF at a time when MSF and other organizations are recognizing the scale and urgency of the problem we are facing with the climate crisis. And so the opportunity that I have to help sort of guide and support MSF understanding what that looks like in terms of health problems on the ground in some of the world's most vulnerable countries and figure out how we as an organization can be a more responsible humanitarian actor and, you know, minimize our own environmental impact, that's a fantastic challenge for me. I came to Geneva while working for the World Health Organization. I'd gotten my start with them back in 2011, working in the South Pacific office, working on the topic of climate change and health. That then ended up dominating the next few years of my life, not just from a project perspective. So I was working across 12 different countries in the Pacific, assessing their vulnerabilities to climate change, health vulnerabilities to climate change while working at WHO. And I also did my PhD on that topic. So having done that role with WHO, I then worked in several other capacities and regions around the world for them. And eventually they called me up to Geneva, to the WHO headquarters here. And after my contract had finished there, I was fortunate to be able to snag a job at MSF headquarters, where I've been for most of the last 7 years.
Now, speaking of climate change, in November, the Clinical Senate held a meeting about healthcare and climate change, and this is obviously an area of particular interest for you. Why are you so passionate about it?
Well, look, first of all, I think it's important to draw a distinction between healthcare and climate change and health and climate change more broadly, Rebecca. Healthcare and climate change, I think, refers to the health system's response to the crisis. The health and climate change refers more to the impact of the crisis. So that impact side was really what got me initially curious and then increasingly concerned when I started looking into it. Just very briefly, my journey in this space started in 2007 when I was doing the public health resident medical officer job I mentioned briefly earlier in our chat. I was working up in the Kimberley, and a key part of my role was monitoring the infectious diseases database for the notifiable diseases. And I was particularly interested in arboviruses, viruses transmitted by insects, particularly mosquitoes, which in that part of the West Kimberley was mostly Ross River virus. And so looking over years and years of Ross River virus data, it was very clear that there were patterns to the incident, the rates at which the disease was affecting people, and that they were mostly very closely linked to weather and environmental conditions, particularly temperature, rainfall and humidity. And so I ended up doing a little research project on that with some colleagues, and we could see that not only were the cases of Ross River virus linked to those environmental meteorological conditions, they could be predicted. And so our intention was to try and develop some early warning systems to try and minimize the scale of the epidemics that would inevitably occur. And as you can imagine, that kind of research and the background reading and the literature review and the sort of education that I had to do to get that project done opened up this whole Pandora's box of information for me around the relationship between weather and climate and health. And I realized back then that this was a huge deal and that I'd never heard anything about in my medical training up to that point. WHO had been working on that topic for over 20 years by that stage. Keep in mind, this is back in 2007. And there were public health experts from all around the world really sounding the alarm, frantically sounding the alarm about what this meant for human health. And I was like, well hang on, how am I just hearing about this now out here on my own? And so that really somewhat circuitously led me to the role with WHO in the South Pacific, by which time WHO was really trying to step up its work in the climate change and health space, in particular supporting countries figure out what climate change meant for the health of their populations and what they could do to try and minimize those impacts. So the Pacific Islands, as you and all your listeners would know, it's really the kind of ground zero for climate change in terms of the physical impact and the health impacts as well. And as I spent years working around the Pacific for WHO, researching in collaboration with other experts what climate change meant for the health of Pacific Island people, the one word conclusion was devastation. And this not only was fascinating from a scientific perspective, it was extremely frustrating from a sort of moral, ethical perspective. It deeply, deeply concerned me that this problem that I was seeing so clearly in these communities around the Pacific and that was also occurring all around the world was being very unequally and inequitably distributed. So the people most affected by climate change, including those that are dying by the millions every year due to climate change already, are those who have contributed the least to the problem. And so this sort of moral paradox has been a key part of my, I guess, crusade in relation to the work on climate change over the last 15, 16 years now.
So in your current role, can you share with us a project that you're working on that relates to climate change and health?
Yeah, we have quite a few on the go. So in Kiribati, remote Pacific Island nation and an atoll country straddling the equator, we have a maternal child health project, which very clearly acknowledges the role of climate change and its impact on food insecurity, water insecurity, impacts on non-communicable diseases, the spread of infectious diseases. So we've got maternal child health as the focus of our work, but all these obvious connections to the environment and climate change that we are trying to understand to be able to help our patients and support the populations where we're working in Kiribati. That's kind of a non-communicable disease focused project. In Madagascar, the combination of climate change, deforestation, and biodiversity loss has meant that essentially the southern third of the country is almost unlivable, suffering from chronic severe malnutrition, and the east coast is being battered by increasingly frequent severe cyclones. So with the malnutrition, the extreme weather events, and endemic malaria and neglected tropical diseases, all creating this very messy, dangerous potpourri of health problems for the population there. In Mozambique, we've got a project that's going even deeper into the neglected tropical diseases, particularly schistosomiasis and lymphatic filariasis, respectively water and mosquito linked, that are changing along with malaria due to climate change. And then going north, South Sudan, worst floods in generations have been going on essentially nonstop for months now, causing huge displacement of populations, along with severe food insecurity and a long-term epidemic of snake bite, right? Because it's not just the people that get displaced by these floods. So yeah, multiple tragic examples of where climate change is affecting the health of populations where we work. And on the healthcare side, we are trying our best to address, as I mentioned earlier, our own environmental impact, including carbon emissions, and help make the health facilities where we work more resilient to climate change and environmental shocks.
It's incredible the work that you're doing, Lachlan. What changes would you like to see health systems make that could positively impact the climate?
So the health sector contributes very, very substantially to the overall carbon emissions at a societal level. Yeah. Of course, healthcare is essential, not disputing that. Big fan of access and equity of healthcare. But I think as health professionals, we have made a commitment. In fact, most of us have taken an oath to do no harm, right? Primum non nocere, that's what most clinicians commit to at the very beginning of their careers. And we need to keep that in mind as we are doing our work, that our work and the impact of the health sector is actually doing harm. So I think we have a professional and moral and ethical responsibility to understand and analyze what the environmental impacts of healthcare provision are and reduce those to the maximum extent possible without compromising the quality of care that we're able to provide our patients. Now, concretely, what that fundamentally means is follow the energy. That's not a quote from me. I had a meeting yesterday with Nick Watts. He's another Aussie doctor who's on a crusade to try and, you know, help the world address climate change. He's a fascinating character who has been leading the NHS's attempt to reduce their own emissions in the UK, the UK National Health Service. So he's been working in this space for several years in a huge health system like that. And his key message is go where the biggest gains or the biggest reductions, more accurately, are to be made. And that's about energy use in the healthcare system. So look, the small things, you know, reducing or rationalizing single-use disposable materials, eliminating, you know, highly toxic elements like desflurane, the anesthetic volatile gases. Those initiatives are excellent and they are important, but the biggest bang for our buck in terms of the health sector's response to or commitment to tackling climate change is energy efficiency and making the transition from burning dead dinosaurs and prehistoric forests as a source of energy to having a sustainable model of energy use.
Lachlan, you mentioned earlier in the interview about the books that you've written, and you've co-authored a number of books on climate change and global health. What message do you hope your books leave people with?
Fundamentally, Rebecca, my hope and intention, and dare I say expectation, is that the books will help readers and just the public, and in particular policymakers, to understand the true nature and scale of the crisis that we are all facing. No one is exempt. But rich countries and people who live in resource-rich environments have the ability to put their heads in the sand and shelter and skulk in air-conditioned comfort or ignore the impact of what is happening around us. But for the majority of the world, yeah, climate change is devastating and increasingly so. And what I think most people still are failing to understand is that this is a problem that's happening now. It's a problem that is universal, and it's a problem that's affecting our health. This isn't just an environmental problem or a problem for poor people in faraway places or for future generations. This is a problem now that's affecting all of us, that's going to affect our children and our grandchildren, and we cannot ignore it, nor can we escape it. So my message would be, or is, that the climate crisis is a health crisis, and we collectively as a society need to understand that so that we can be enabled and empowered and motivated to take the actions that are urgently required to slow, halt, and reverse the drivers and impacts of climate change. So the books that you mentioned are mostly WHO publications and fairly desiccated textbooks and the like. Those have an audience, I guess, but it's pretty limited. But the main motivation for me writing my main book was to try and make that information more accessible to more people.
So, Lachlan, your main book is all about climate change?
It's not just about climate change. I'm also very interested in, concerned about, preoccupied by Indigenous health inequities. I've also spent years working on the huge complex challenge of antimicrobial resistance and have seen the worst case scenarios of what that looks like in several parts of the world. So they're three key messages that are included in the book.
Now, you're a medical doctor, an author, a musician. Are there any other talents that you're hiding and could possibly fit into your life?
That's a very generous characterisation. Look, I am but a humble rural doctor from Millamilla, Rebecca. I'm not too big for my boots by any means. My wife's Mexican and we love Spanish food, so I make a pretty mean paella, so there's that. Look, the other thing that I'm reasonably proud of, I guess, is that I'm a scuba dive master. That was, exploring the underwater world has been a big part of my life for the last quarter century or so. Unfortunately, over that time period, I've seen really devastating impacts, particularly on reefs, including the Great Barrier Reef, due to ocean warming, acidification, industrial contamination, etc. So, look, it saddens me that future generations will not have the same experience of diving, particularly tropical reef diving, that I have been privileged to have. But it was kind of my backup career for a long time. If the whole medicine thing didn't work out, probably still is, if I eventually realize that medicine, if I can't make a go of it, I'll just go back to diving.
Now, before we let you go, because it is morning there where you are, how does life in Switzerland compare with Millamilla?
Look, there's a few more restaurants here than in Millamilla. There are higher mountains. There are flights to just about anywhere and trains. There are many things that Switzerland has and Geneva has that Millamilla doesn't have. But as I say, Millamilla will always be my spiritual home. And the adventures that I had as a kid, exploring the rainforest, discovering waterfalls, riding motorbikes, working hard on the farm, hanging out with my cousins, being brought up with an authentic country kid lifestyle is something that has really helped shape the person I have come to be. And although, I don't yearn to return to Millamilla to live indefinitely, I'm very proud of my upbringing and to call that home.
Well, that is a wonderful story. It's been brilliant talking with you, Lachlan. I've thoroughly enjoyed it. Thank you so much.
Oh, I've had a blast, Rebecca. Thanks again for having me.